Hey, Department fam, Omar here. Before we get into the conversation, I first want to just thank you for being locked in. You're signaling to me that you value leveling up either in business and or in life. And more than anything, the fact that you would use me and trust me for that information means the world to me. I do want to invite you to the next Content to Cash Challenge coming up pretty soon here. This is a 5-day live coaching experience with myself, and it's an environment unlike any other environment where I literally open up the hood to my business and I show you how I'm making 7 figures online part-time, all by building my personal brand, and how you could stop chasing business and start having business chase you. You know what's crazy? Since building my personal brand, I don't have an opportunity problem. Opportunity is actually my problem. And so if you want that same problem, which is a good problem, I want to see you at the next Content to Cash Challenge. You can find the link in the description to get signed up. Now let's get into this fire conversation.
If you want to be a world-class communicator, it's not how long is your message, but how long are they experiencing the message. And if you can create an experience where they feel like they've only been there for 5 minutes, now you're learning the art of communication.
How do people get reps? You're not standing on stages. You're not in front of people.
If you feel like you're called to speak, you have something to say, nothing's going to stop you from saying it. No one was inviting me to speak in their organizations. So I started in street corners and I would speak every Sunday to all the homeless there. No one invited me. I created every single space that I spoke in for years. And it really transformed a lot of my communication. Most preaching and speaking pushes out and doesn't pull in. I want to bring the audience in. And before the talk is over, it's just you and me, one-on-one, even if there's 20,000 people in the room.
How do you help people on the journey of becoming a better communicator find their voice?
You know, one of the things you want to do in any environment, whether it's a podcast or anything, there's this interesting tension. You have to always be...
That's the number one mistake people have when they open the Bibles.
We should probably be recording this.
We are rolling.
Okay.
So we'll just start. Hey, Erwin, thank you. Welcome for being back on the pod. OG, you were under the first 10 episodes, you and Aaron, and just really cool. I mean, I've admired you forever, and really cool. Even Pastor Jabin, my pastor, recently you guys got connected. Yeah, man, I guess we could talk about whatever. Something I did want to bring up is something that made him super happy because he looked up to you too, you know, is like, you were like, dude, you're like my new favorite preacher.
you know why I said that?
Yeah, that's, I want to know.
Because
more about it.
There are a lot of great, I put communicators and preachers almost in different categories sometimes, you know.
What about comedians?
Comedians too. Okay. That's a whole different category. Okay. That's like maybe my most elevated category. And but I know Jabin has a style. And I've been watching, because I didn't know Jabin really, you know. And my kids both came to me after he spoke in Miami at VU and said, hey, Dad, you should get Jabin to come speak. Mm-hmm. And you know, I just do what I'm told. And so I went up to Jabin and I asked him if he would be willing to come speak. And he was really gracious and let me know how his wife came to faith through my teaching, which I did not know, which was really moving to me. And I love those relational, you know, intersections, right? Yeah. You know, it makes you feel like your story has begun way before you knew, you know? And so I started watching some of his clips and he's, you know, he's probably stylistically more Pentecostal in some of his approaches than, you know, our LA community is probably accustomed to. And I watched how he adjusted himself to our people. Mm. And when a person is willing to have a deep sense of connectedness with the room, and he was completely himself, but he was the himself that room needed. Wow. And that's what made me really love him as a speaker. And because I felt like he really honored the space, connected people, was very authentic. And I have really, really high value, you know, for authenticity. And super enjoyable, a good mind. Mm-hmm. And I do have a value for intelligence. You know, I like people who think and are thoughtful and aren't sharing things just on a superficial level, but you can tell that there's something behind what they've said. You can, by the way, you can always tell when someone is using a quote from someone else as if it's their own.
How so?
They don't know how to explain how they got there. And so when you hear a quote from someone, you go, oh, I like that. That person had a process to get to that insight.
Right.
And so then when you just steal the insight, when you're speaking, it doesn't have the same power because you don't understand the process that got that gets you to that insight. Mm-hmm. And so you can always feel like there's this almost like a thought gap between the thought and the process.
There's a lot. I mean, yeah. What's so cool is like literally Jamin texted me before this because I'm preaching this weekend and he's been my like biggest voice helping me find my voice. Mm. And I think what, I mean, he's in my world, he's hit a level of mastery, 23 years in ministry,
yeah.
Big churches, small churches, building a church, you know, in a city like Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. But something he told me was like, most people think when you don't quote somebody you're taking something from that you'll seem smarter. But when, in all honesty, when you give them the credit, you actually look more studious.
Yeah, because it looks like you actually researched.
Right.
Paid attention. It also gives you the bridge to that truth without you having to have all the process, you know? And, you know, when I can say E equals MC squared, and I always thought it was kind of cool because, you know, it's my name actually, Irwin McManus. Oh,
yeah, that's funny. And,
so from a very young age, I identified myself. That was like, my name is E equals MC squared. But I don't understand the process that it took Einstein to get there. Mm. And so I could even give you a formulaic explanation, but the texture would be lost. And it's the same way when someone quotes and says whatever, what's a great like cliche? Rejection is God's protection, right? Everybody loves that, right? Yeah. It makes me cringe every time I hear it. And I hate cliches. That's just the way I'm set. Yeah. And I know, I'm trying to get softer. Like, you know, I know people like them and people need them and they help you hold truth and they help you solve like psychological problems and, you know, rejection is God's protection. But I'm like, yeah, but in the rejection, it just feels like rejection. You know, it doesn't feel like anyone's doing anything for you. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes rejection is really people's inability to see new options for the future. Mm. You know, and so I don't know if it's always protection or whether it's just actually the fact that if you're a pioneer, you're an inventor, you're an innovator, 99% of people are going to reject what you see because that's why it's an innovation. Mm. Sometimes a rejection is simply confirmation that this idea is so new that it's almost unacceptable. You have to decide if it's worth fighting for.
Wow.
But so I just picked that as one illustration of everyone hears that cliche, everyone uses it. And when you use it like it's your insight, you know when it matters is when someone has been so brutally rejected and they go, and I just saw it as God's protection. It changes the depth of it. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Right, 100.
Yeah.
So it's so good. Well, like I think people do that in the journey of finding their voice, finding their style.
Yeah.
And I almost feel like even, like I consider myself a young communicator, you know, started preaching in my first sermon in 2019, making content on video, but like I'll probably preach 4 to 6 times a year, do conferences, maybe, you know, half a dozen times, speak in front of small rooms, big rooms. And I'm like, am I a handheld guy? Am I a teaching guy? You know, how do you help people on the journey of becoming a better communicator find their voice?
That's such an interesting nuance you pick. Am I a handheld guy or am I a headset mic, you know, a Britney Spears guy?
Yes, Britney Spears.
because your choice actually reflects a preaching style. Mm-hmm. And I always used a headset for a long time, but I would always take that little bubble off of it so people couldn't see it.
Yeah.
Because
the church has a black one. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can't even see it with your beard.
And my team will confirm this to you, but I emit so much energy that headsets usually short circuit. Mm. So I use handhelds. In fact, I recently tried it someplace and I said, let's just give it a shot. And then it short-circuited within a minute or two and they had to hand me the handheld. And my team's like, why do you do this? Mm-hmm. But we did discover that if I speak on a carpeted floor, I have a better chance to be able to use the headset.
Oh, wow.
But if it's not carpeted, it's almost impossible. And but the handheld, I had a hard time with it because it was, for me, I associated it with old time Pentecostal preachers who were on television, and like the Jimmy Swaggerts, you know. And so for me, the handheld was a symbol of inauthenticity, corruption, and manipulation.
Wow.
I had to get over it. And, you know, when my teams handed me a handheld, and then what helped me was watching people I liked use a handheld. And so it's interesting how even instruments are connected to your response and reaction to people. But one of the greatest, I think, moments I had as a speaker was I spoke at in Queens at, I don't know if you know Chris D'Urso.
Yeah.
Wonderful, wonderful human being. Yeah,
he did the Tabernacle, and then, I don't know, I mean, he's been killing it on IG recently with some posts.
That's about awesome.
Insecurity and stuff. Anyway, go ahead.
So he did this conference, and right before I spoke, they did the offering, and somebody got up there and did like a 40-minute offering talk.
Wow.
Which, like, you know, full-blown sermon, and he was good. He was very, very animated, really very, you know, Pentecostal in the style and everything. So I thought, what do I do? I mean, how do you go up after a guy that really just preached for 40 minutes when it's supposed to be a 3-minute offering talk? And so I had them just put a stand out there and put the microphone on the stand, and I spoke just standing there.
Wow.
And it was probably one of the most powerful talks that I've given. And because I chose a different like methodology, and it changed the whole texture of the message, which for me actually goes back to your original question about what about comics? Mm-hmm. Because a lot of the old school stand-up comics used that microphone just like that.
Yeah.
And I still had that imagery in my mind of how when everything is immobile, you have to do something else to capture the audience. Because a lot of times, you know, we're trying to capture audience. We move, right? You know, you want to make sure you got the audience with you. You got to walk up and down. And so you create all this almost like a frenetic energy. And we consider that charisma, or we consider that, like the energy of the crowd, but really it's us working a room. And a lot of times I would test myself. I would go, put yourself in a situation where the only real energy is soul to soul. Where I'm not trying to work a room, when I'm not trying to get everybody up. And so at Mosaic, you know, our community in Los Angeles years ago, almost over a decade, probably over a decade ago, I made a decision and I sat on a stool, and no one in the world was sitting on a stool at that time. And I sat on a stool and I spoke for probably a year just sitting on that stool. And my focus was, I want to bring the power of my messaging from my soul, my gut, my core, and sitting. And so I knew that I had to bring a different kind of kinetic energy to the room, because you could sit on a stool and be really boring, right? You know? And it really transformed a lot of my communication, because I learned how to communicate from a different, I'm gonna say a different frequency. Most preaching and speaking pushes out and doesn't pull in. And a huge part of what I focus on in communication is I want to bring the audience in. I want the almost like the metaphysical experience to be that the distance between you and me is getting closer and closer and closer. And before the talk is over, it's just you and me, one-on-one, even if there's 20,000 people in the room. And so I actually, you know, think of communication as like this incredible art form, but it's also something like profoundly spiritual.
Sure.
And all that matters, right? You know, but and so with that situation there, sometimes it's better to ask yourself, what does this moment need? Not, you know, what do I need from this moment, right? You know, and it's true even when you're, you're doing podcasts, right? You know, have you ever done them? I shouldn't ask you that, but.
Ask me it.
Have you done a podcast with someone you realized all their answers are canned?
Literally 2 weeks ago.
Okay. I interviewed someone, and because I was asked to interview them in a very large environment, and like probably 100,000 people watching it live. And before I got there, they said, these are the questions you're allowed to ask. I never do that. Like, I, you know.
Yeah.
And And of course, I asked a few different questions anyway. And every answer was so scripted that you never got to know them. I might as well have been speaking to the tile.
Yeah.
You know, and because there was no giving of themselves. And, you know, one of the things you want to do in any environment, whether it's a podcast or anything, is whatever like process you need to go through, but if you can bring your most authentic self and try not to worry about how you look or how, you know, and just be experienced as a human, that's when it becomes more powerful.
Yeah.
It's really hard when someone's so afraid to be seen negatively that they really can't be seen positively. It just becomes a neutral.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, my biggest observation in that it didn't happen until I did a podcast with somebody early on. And then this person spoke at an event and I was at the event watching it. And there was a few people that seen my podcast with this person. And they even noticed it. It was like, literally, it's almost as if he was doing the podcast just on stage. And so it's like, and I think this is cool to bring up because like sometimes you have like one message for a season that you want to really push. Like, you know, your last book, Seven Frequencies of Communication, you're going on different stages and podcasts to promote the book, but where do you draw that line of like, I want to push the message that why I'm here for versus like, this is what I'm feeling right now, bro.
Yeah, you see, I think I'm an extreme on the other end. Like, I never mentioned my book to you.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't even know you had a copy of it or anything like that, you know?
Yeah, you know, I just got a signed copy.
The likelihood I would bring it up is really close to zero.
Yeah.
You know, because I really don't think of myself as going to promote something. You know, my team's always going, hey, would you remember to mention the book, you know, as much as you can. What I like talking about, if I'm talking about like something like the book, is am I still learning? Like, if I haven't learned anything since I wrote the book, I probably won't talk about it. But I've learned so much since I've written the book that I could write a whole other book.
So good.
And in fact, we actually thought that I would publish a book just on the shadows because I've learned so much in the last 2 years on the shadows. And the only reason I would ever be interested in writing or talking about one of my books in some way is that I'm still learning.
Yeah.
And because otherwise it just feels flat. Sure. It's static to me.
Hey, department fam, question for you. Based on you listening to this podcast, you probably are either looking to grow your personal brand this year, build your audience online, and just stop chasing business and start to have business chasing you. If that's you, I want to invite you to the Content to Cash Challenge. This is a 5-day coaching experience, a live coaching experience with myself that's done all on Zoom, and you get access to a private community, and it really is unlike any other experience that I offer. By the end of the challenge, you'll have unreal clarity on what you're supposed to do online, and you'll have the insight on how you can make an extra 6 or even 7 figures. Yes, I said 7 figures in your business this year. And if any of those things sound great to you, I want you to join the next Content to Cash Challenge. Scan the QR code if you're watching on a television or click the link in the description. Once you go through it, go ahead and upgrade to VIP because you'll get an extra hour of bonus VIP Q&A with me every single day of the challenge. And so looking forward to seeing you there. Let's get back into the convo. That's so good. I mean, and I think there's principles in everything you're saying, you know, like that's something about you being a communicator who speaks almost weekly. Speaks weekly in so many contexts. You got Zoom calls, Sundays at church, you're doing an event tomorrow here in Vegas. And but you're a student. I think that's a big thing people overlook is when an expert is up there, they assume those are people who have arrived.
Yeah.
When really most of the time they're up there because they're still discovering.
Yeah.
Yeah. Something that came up was the concept of, like you said, like you had the mic stand, but there are times I've seen you where you know, you go all in and it's like big passion, charismatic, or even we can call it animated.
Yeah.
And let's call it animated. Cause like Neil's chilling right here, our friend Neil. And I would say Neil is a pretty chill, reserved person, but he's built a movement just being himself, pretty reserved, backwards hat, you know?
Yeah.
I think the question is like, how do you weigh doing things that you see great communicators? Maybe it communicates to me that this is great communication. I'd like to like start including this type of thing.
Yeah, it's kind of That's a really good question, because I feel really, I don't know, the word kind of is like I feel like I have multiple personality, you know, disorder in that. For a lot of years, I led a black church for about 10 years. And my style of communication was very different. Mm-hmm. And I'm a really good black preacher. and I like it. Like, it doesn't feel inauthentic to me. It's like it's like an art form. I think some of the greatest communicators in human history are black preachers, black communicators. It's just like, you know, there's nothing like black gospel. Mm-hmm. Right? You know, when you hear black gospel, you realize, wow, this is a genre all of its own.
Yeah.
It just exists, and it's extraordinary. And even if you don't listen to black gospel every day, when you hear great black gospel, you can't help not be moved. Mm-hmm. And you know, when you realize that some of the great genres came out of like spiritual spaces, right? You know, and jazz, you know, there's just something about jazz that's just brilliant. And when you watch like raw jazz, it's very different, you know, the kind of the original expressions of improvisation, and it's pretty extraordinary. And I see communication like that, where I had a season of my life where I was just more jazz, and a season of my life I was more black gospel, and season of my life I'm a little more Radiohead, and season of my life I was Depeche Mode, and I keep evolving and changing as a person. I keep growing and adjusting. I keep learning and experiencing people, because I'm the sum total of all the experiences of all the people I've ever had in my life, and I allow them to affect me and change me. And you know, and so sometimes I think to myself, I had this thought recently, man, I just wish I could find a way to just have the organ play behind me and just preach the way I used to preach. And because there's just something visceral about it, something dynamic about it. But I've kind of gone, it feels like, for me now, it's like Beyonce going to country. Mm. You know, it's like I so defined myself in a genre that if I spoke in another genre, it would confuse people. Mm. But it actually wouldn't be inauthentic to me. And so I think some people have a style.
Yeah.
And it's really like rooted in who they are. It's almost like Keanu Reeves. He has a style. And you know it's authentic to Keanu, and he can play a lot of different characters, but all those characters kind of stay in that same world, right? Yeah. Like Tom Cruise, has a style, yeah. Right? You know, whether it's Mission Impossible or Top Gun, like every character kind of comes out of the genre of Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
But then you have like Daniel Day-Lewis, you know, who he doesn't have a style. He absorbs a reality and then becomes an authentic expression of that. And so in some kind of unusual way, I'm more like that. Like if I live in a world, I will know how to communicate in that world. Mm. It's just, I just absorb it and becomes a part of who I am.
Who gives you the permission, or where do you get the permission to move in that?
That's a really good question. I think maybe I was so introverted and so reclusive and shy as a child that I don't think I had discovered the style. Mm. You know, I was like a blank slate, even with my accent. I mean, I'm an immigrant from El Salvador. You know, Spanish was my first language. I learned English here in the States. My mom still has an accent. I don't have an accent because I listened to Peter Jennings, who was a newscaster. I liked the way he spoke, and I thought I'm going to learn how to speak like him. But when I lived in Queens, I talked like a New Yorker, you know? And when I lived in Miami, I spoke, you know, more Miami. And, you know, when I was in the Northwest, I started picking up all the Oregon, you know, accent, and California changed my accent. And when I was in Texas, I spoke like I was from Texas. And when I lived in North Carolina, because I went to Chapel Hill, I spoke like this all the time. And I'd listen to my talks. I had no idea my accents changed. Because accents are actually the product of listening. That when you listen to people, you learn their accents. Mm. Most of us don't actually listen as much as we talk. And so I realized from a really young age that one of my superpowers is listening. And so because I'm a really good listener, I would just naturally absorb whatever accents I lived in. Within weeks, I would speak like the people in those spaces. And so my Spanish goes crazy because if I'm in Colombia, I start picking up a Colombian accent. When I'm in, you know, if I'm in Barcelona, I start picking up a Barcelona accent. And so then people ask me in Mexico, are you from Italy? Because, you know, my Spanish is so jarbled up and it kind of moves along. And I just think that I'm highly adaptive. I think most communicators find like their flow or find their, you know, their voice, and then it's hard for them to adapt it to different spaces. And I actually think if you want to be a world-class leader, there's this interest or communicator, there's this interesting tension. You have to always be authentic to who you are. You can't lose that. And then you have to be as adaptive to the world you're in as possible. And so it's almost like you have to be a peach.
Really good.
You're soft on the outside, hard in the center. You know, and what people experience is the adaptive part of your nature. But what is really, to me, transformative is a part of you that doesn't change. And so that's the journey I've been on probably all my life as a communicator.
Yeah, it was one of the best compliments I feel like I've gotten is that was the most you. Like from somebody that really knows me. And it's like, I always think I'm trying to be me, but it's just the reps. But on a practical level, because I'm so grateful I get the opportunity to exercise, you know, my communication skill or gift, which by the way, what is it? Is it a skill or is it a gift?
I think it's both.
It's both. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So you gotta work on it and discover it and all that stuff. But on a practical note, how do people get reps? Like if you're not standing on stages, you're not in front of people, but you want to be better at communicating, like how do you exercise the skill or?
Yeah, it's funny. It's like asking the question, you know, if you didn't get a college scholarship, how do you get better at basketball? You just play on the streets. You know, it's like, you know, how do you get reps? I'm like, how do you not get reps? If you feel like you're called to speak or you have something to say, nothing's going to stop you from saying it. And so I look back and I look, all right, where did I start speaking? Well, no one was inviting me to speak in their organizations. No one was inviting me to speak in their churches. And I mean, imagine being me in my 20s. They just thought I was insane. And so I started in street corners. And I went to all the donut shops in Fort Worth when I was in school there and got all the donut shops to give me their day-old donuts for free on Sunday mornings. And they got a coffee pot and filled it with coffee, took it to downtown Fort Worth, set up coffee and donuts, and I would speak every Sunday to all the homeless there. And so no one invited me. I created my own space.
Boom.
You know, I was a musician. I would take my guitar, I remember going to a Sizzler steakhouse, nothing fancy, saying, hey, can I do a concert for free in your restaurant during rush hour? And they go, all right, you know. And then I would do a concert and then I'd speak to the whole room. I would take my basketball into the projects and usually they'd send someone out to play one-on-one with me to see if I was worthy of being on their court. And I would bring basketballs. We'd have our one-on-one, guys would come and then I'd speak. You know, I started a soccer team in an international league and at halftime, our guys would, you know, go to the other stadium side and talk and speak there. I would go to Mardi Gras every year with my guitar, stand on corners till I had a large crowd, and then I talked to them all about Jesus. And so no one invited me. I created every single space that I spoke in for years. And you want to learn how to be a communicator? Be a communicator in the middle of Mardi Gras in the Vukaray, where everybody's drunk, doing drugs, and they're yelling and screaming at you, and you got witches, and you've got people practicing Santeria, and you have, you know, and all this, you know, hedonistic sex happening all around you, and you're talking to them about how God can change their life, and they're yelling at you and screaming at you, and you're going back and forth, and I learned stand up by speaking in open air environments, And I learned how to be funny and being in places where people are antagonistic and could throw things. And so I don't know how other people learn how to speak, but that's how I learned how to speak.
That's good. I mean, the principle is that you can create your own stage. And yeah. I mean, the thing with like content and stuff, it's like you actually can get the reps with no one's permission, which mm-hmm. is great. And you got no one's permission to just
yeah.
go and, you know, talk. It might be because like what I get a sense is people like the idea of being on someone else's stage
yeah.
because it probably would serve them in a way. But what I get from even your journey from getting in front of people, you took the servant's heart, the servant's mentality, and that's how you got the reps. Like, how can I use my voice to serve people?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, my quote first, well, I think it was my first church, really, was a duplex in South Dallas in the highest crime rate, murder rate area of the United States at that time. And I just walked the streets, met people, invited them to come. And, it, you know, and that's how I began that journey there. And you just have to be available, right, as much as possible. And I mean, the first time someone actually asked me to speak, I still remember that, like in their church. It was so shocking to me. But you know how it happened? I was at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. This is the first time I ever spoke at a church. I spoke at other things that I had invented. And, I went to this church that someone invited me to. And I went up to the pastor and I said, hey, I'm going home for the summer. When I come back in the fall, I would love to volunteer to be your janitor. And he was, I think, a little surprised. And, you know, and I was totally sincere. I thought, you know, one thing I could qualify for is to clean the building. And, you know, and so I'm just going to volunteer. And so I left him my name and number. And I said, when I come back, you know, to Chapel Hill in the fall, I would love to be able to clean the building. And a week before I got back to school, I got a letter from that pastor saying, when you get back on Sunday, I'd like for you to talk for 3 minutes and share your story of how you came to faith. And then the next week, I want you to give a message. Mm. This man didn't even know me.
Wow.
But it was because I volunteered to be the janitor. And he never had anyone volunteer to be the janitor. And so he decided if he was willing to be the janitor, I'm willing to put him on stage. And I was awful. Wow. But it was like he entrusted me with that. It was so valuable, and then I ended up becoming a regular speaker in that church.
Wow!
And then I I've been hired for like a summer internship at this church in Orlando that I think had 140 acres of land and you know, maybe 20,000 members. It was a massive church. And I'm about to go home from Chapel Hill to Orlando to go work at this church. It is very prestigious, but it's where we came to faith. So, you know, they gave us an internship. And this man walks into my room in Chapel Hill and he said, hey, you're Irwin McManus? And I said, yeah. And he goes, Bob gave me your name. He was the guy that I asked to be the janitor. He goes, I need someone to help me. I'm starting a church. And, you know, I'm 20, 21 years old, you know, new in my faith, brand new in my faith. He goes, would you come help me? I said, I already committed to go to this church in Orlando. I told him about it. And he goes, that church could hire 1,000 people tomorrow to replace you. But you're the only person that could help us. So I called my mom and family in that church and I said, I'm not coming. And I went and helped that little tiny startup. And then that man, the next week, was diagnosed with hepatitis C and was in bed. And he said, I know you came here just to help me with youth, but you're going to have to lead the whole church and speak all summer.
Wow.
And so going as a free youth pastor to like 5 kids to help this church get started, I ended up starting the church from scratch myself and speaking every week. And I think sometimes we keep wanting the platform that gives us prestige rather than accepting the opportunity just to serve someone else. And I think that's why we never learn how to get to the top of the building.
Dang.
You know.
So good. Well, when it comes to like, because there's a few thoughts that I have. There's the attention span now. Like we're in hook revolution. Like it's all about the hook. Attention spans are shrinking. But you've been communicating for decades in front of audiences and crowds.
Mm-hmm.
What have you seen shift wise as far as the approach to connect more, knowing all that's distracting us?
Yeah, it's been probably at least a decade since the conversation has shifted to attention spans are so short that you can't do long talks. Mm-hmm. And what was interesting at Mosaic is my average talk was 57 minutes. Like I would just hit 57 on the nose every single week. But then when you're doing a ton of gatherings and you're having to move from location to location, you got to crunch them down.
Right.
I think that there is a ratio. If you have a high gifting for communication, you can speak longer. If you aren't, you know, yet there, you have to make sure it's shorter. You know, to me, the rule of thumb is don't speak longer than people listen. Mm. You know, stop at least 3 minutes before everyone stops listening. Mm. And some of that takes self-awareness. You have to really look at the room and go, I've lost the room. And so then you realize, okay, I can keep them for 14 minutes. I can keep them for 8 minutes. You know, I can keep them for 20 minutes. And what it is that to me, you keep everyone in 3 to 7 minute segments. It's how many of those can you artfully connect together that decide how long your talk is.
Really cool.
And so if you don't think, I don't have a 50 minute talk. I have a Netflix series that I'm going to have you binge. And it's going to be my talk.
That's such a cool way to look at it.
Right, because I just finished watching, have you seen Department Q? Oh man, it's
fire.
It's interesting. Okay. I mean, I like bizarre shows anyway, but I watched episode one. And then the next day, I watched the next 7 episodes all through the night because I don't sleep a lot. And I just binged it because I just, every time it ended, I had to, I shouldn't be confessing this. Anybody else ever binge a show?
No, we're guilty, bro. Okay. Like, you didn't have to hide.
I'm just being honest. Like, yeah, you know, I binge things. I know I'm not that guy. I get up at 4 a.m. You don't do Netflix. you know, you only work out. You know, you make $1 million a day. Now, some days I'm just binging Netflix and that's just, you know, who I am and ordering pizza. But what happened? They know the art of how to close a story where you can't walk away as the story opens up. So communication is, can you move from 3 to 7 minute modules where you're closing a story while you're opening a new one where they want to go with you? Can you get them to binge your talk? And the most exciting moment is when someone says, I could have listened forever. Mm. It means you got them in a binge pattern.
So good.
Right? You know,
yeah.
I can't believe it's over.
I even think that framework or that way of thinking around it would help you memorize it too.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause like it's pocketed, you
know? It is. And I've never used that concept before.
Yeah.
So we're breaking that out.
Let's
here.
Let's go.
And
stealing it.
You know, but it is the way I think.
Yeah.
And process information. And, you know, and so some of it sometimes with my team, because, you know, I work a lot with communicators. The problem is when they're talking and it feels like there's no progress. Mm-hmm. Right. Have you ever listened to a talk and you go, I don't know if we're going anywhere?
Right.
That's actually the problem. Remember, Einstein, going back to E equals MC squared, reminded us or helped us understand that time is relative. And so when, you know, if you step on a nail, that nail being in your foot, it feels like an eternity.
Mm-hmm.
If you're kissing your wife, you know, time stands still. You know, if you're stuck in traffic, it feels like you're there for 10 hours.
Right.
Right. If you're watching a great movie, you feel like it was 3 minutes.
Yep.
Time is relative. It's not how long is your message, but how long are they experiencing the message?
So good.
And if you can create an experience where they feel like they've only been there for 5 minutes, now you're learning the art of communication.
Good.
You know, some people can turn 3 minutes into 5 hours. You know, just right. It's just so painful.
Actually, I mean, I feel like that's like what the Holy Spirit does on Sundays,
mm-hmm.
because you're confined,
mm-hmm.
but so much people get so much out of, and everybody's getting something different because God's speaking to them in different mm-hmm. ways. But like the journey with City Light has been different, like 5 services in this building, mm-hmm. moving to the school. We can go a little bit longer, but we're still trying to 35 minute sermons, but it's crazy how much people are getting.
Yeah.
in 35 minutes. And I think it's just a cool dynamic with people's experiences, mm-hmm. you know, people, if they believe yeah. in the Holy Spirit and all that stuff, but it's just like the way that when you communicate in a way that connects people in that way, it's like, yeah, time is irrelevant.
Yeah. yeah. I always tell people, like, if you give me 25 minutes or 45 minutes, the difference is actually not content. It's how funny I will be. And if it's shorter, I will be less funny. Yeah. And if it's longer, I'll be funnier. And because one of the things is that humor allows time to become irrelevant. Because when people are laughing, they're not thinking about how long this is taking. Mm-hmm. And it also, humor opens up the other aspects of the human soul that they're unaware are being opened.
Wow.
And so when someone's laughing, they become incredibly open to an intensity that's coming after it. And so there's, so I think humor is probably like the ability to be comedic is one of the greatest human talents that exists. And in every language, the last thing you learn is comedy.
Wow.
When you're learning a new language, if you can understand a joke, you've learned the language. If you're learning a language and you can tell a joke, not a planned joke, but a natural joke, you've actually learned the language. And so when I started going to Mexico City, and I knew that the language was mine when the room was laughing. And it's also in the ways I know where the room is still with me. Because when they laugh.
Yeah.
Right. And so that's a part of it too, because it's harder to craft a great 4-minute talk. I mean, you really have to be world class to have a 4-minute talk that shakes a room. And it's almost as hard to do an 8 or 9 minute talk. Those are really hard. And to do that where there's a completed thought, where you've taken people on an entire journey in 9 minutes. Can you imagine that?
No, it's wild.
You know, that's a short film.
Yeah.
And it's easier to do that over 45, but the danger there is that you think since you have 45 minutes, you can avoid making progress. And that's where it goes bad. You know, as a writer, and I thought maybe I'd give you this framework, because you mentioned something earlier that I thought, oh, it's true in writing too. When I talk to people about writing, there's like this X and Y graph that works in my head. You need to have two things to have great writing. You need to have progress and you need to have detail. And if you have too much progress, it's like an action film. You don't get to know any of the characters. You know, no one's life is really changing. You're not really emotionally attached, but you love the bomb.
Yeah.
You know, it's just progress without detail doesn't take you into the people in the story. And then if you have detail without progress, bogs you down and you don't feel like you're going anywhere. But when you have this interesting tension between progress and detail, you keep moving forward, you keep giving him detail, that writing is world class. And that comedian, oh, I know what it was. You said when you were speaking, someone said, that was the most you I've ever seen you. One of the irritating editorial notes I would get when I first started writing my books, my editor would send me a note, I need more Irwin. And I'm like, it's all Irwin.
Yeah.
You know, he goes, no. He goes, this section needs more Irwin. And it would irritate me. I go, no, this is bad Irwin, maybe, but it's still Irwin. You know, it's like, maybe this is the Irwin that can't write, you know? And so we were going back and forth on this because he just kept saying, this section needs more Irwin. I said, okay, this out, you can help me. Give me a section that's all Irwin. And then give me a section that's not Irwin. And he sent me a section that he said, this is all Irwin. And then he sent me a section that was, this is not Irwin. And I was shocked. He was absolutely right. Like the all Irwin was a book I wanted to read. And the not Irwin was, wow, what's that guy doing? You know? And what was happening was the Irwin was me without filter. I didn't care what you thought about me. I wanted you to know the truth.
Yep.
The Irwin that wasn't me completely cared about what you thought about me. I was trying to be smart. You know, I was trying to be I was like an engineer, an architect. I was making sure all the pieces fit, but I wouldn't let you see me. And so I had to write a little line on a sheet of paper that I got from Stephen King, really. And on his book on writing. And I would write these words to myself: tell the truth. And you'd think, you know, I'm a pastor, I love Jesus, I try to live my life based on the principles of the scriptures. I consider myself a person of integrity. Telling the truth is really hard. Mm-hmm. Not lying. Not lying is easy. you know, when you develop some level of moral compass and you try to be a person of integrity, you don't lie anymore. You know, not lying isn't hard.
Yeah.
And sometimes even not lying is, you know, tricky, right? Because tell them we're not here. Or why can't you come to the party? Oh, I'm busy. You're not. You don't say, I just don't want to.
Yeah, right.
You know, and so not lying is not as easy as we pretend it is. Mm-hmm. But telling the truth is really hard. Because telling the truth means I don't care whether you accept me or reject me. But I care if you see me or don't see me. And I realized the writing that I had when I was telling the truth was more me. And so when someone says to you, Omar, that was all you, what they're saying is you gave us the gift of letting us see you. And good. And that's a rare gift in life.
Powerful. Yeah. When it comes to what you think about when like how much are you weighing the concept that I'm getting on here to perform, I'm putting on something, mm-hmm. as opposed to being you? I mean, and I'm not saying like, I don't know. I mean, it's a
yeah. I think instead of saying when am I performing and when am I me, I think maybe it's when am I fully present. And when am I absent? Mm. Because when you're not fully present, you're performing. That makes sense?
Yes, that makes
you know?
Sense.
So I don't think you're trying to be fake.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes you're trying to be fake, right? You know, okay, you know, you, if it's a first date, you're trying to fake the whole thing. Mm. I'm awesome, date me again. You know, I mean, there's a dynamic there. We're all protective. But I think what really is we're performing when we're not fully present. And so the process isn't don't be fake, don't be fake, don't be fake. You know, the process is be fully present, be fully here. Don't think about the future. Don't think about tomorrow. Don't think about the past. Think about this moment and show up. And when I show up, I don't perform. Mm-hmm. When I don't show up, the performer shows up.
Good. When you get a thought, I mean, I'm imagining like all your talks or like, mm-hmm. let's say you're going to preach on Sunday. What are you doing with that thought? Like, and how much time do you take to put together a 40-minute sermon?
Yeah, I'm a bad, bad example for things like that.
Because you hit like a level of mastery and it's like you, is that why?
Maybe. Yeah, I think so. Like, you know,
maybe early on, how much time were you giving it?
If you ask my wife, like something happened somewhere along the way. Like, I don't think she would say like this, but she'd get close. I was dumber when we got married. I was more like regular when we got married. And then something along the way began to happen. I think that God, honestly, there's a part of me that feels like God just like erased lines in my brain, mm-hmm. and said, no, you can travel further than this. And if it was even possible to add IQ points, I think God added IQ points. But, you know, if you start with 60, you know, it's okay. You can add some and still keep developing. But there was a point in my life where I felt like my brain opened and you know, you do feel like you step into an experience of enlightenment that we don't talk about a lot. And I'm a little hesitant like to talk about this, you know, but I, and it's funny because when Aaron will introduce me to someone and talk to me, he goes, you have to understand my dad has achieved enlightenment. And when he first said that like 5-6 years ago, it kind of threw me off. And I don't think we talk enough about that, that, you know, because we, when we talk about like the Holy Spirit, it tends to be very temporary, you know, rather than something that actually organically changes in you. And that's where I think we miss, we almost dishonor the Holy Spirit and treat him as if he's an energy or just a force of power, rather than an essence that organically interconnects to us. And if we're integrated in the presence of God, in the presence of the Holy Spirit, we should be able to achieve a level of consciousness that goes beyond human understanding. So I write my talks in 5 seconds. Like they just drop into my mind. Crazy. And you know, and I write my books like, you know, in hours. They just drop into my mind. And I used to be embarrassed, and you know, Kim would go, don't tell people like how you come up with concepts, you know. Except I think I disrespect the process in some ways, because I actually think we're created to live without separation from the mind of God. And that, like, my little brain, you know, can't hold the thoughts of God, except that he designed me for that. So somehow he circumvents the wiring, you know, and, you know, and so, yeah, I don't even know anymore how I write my messages. And we just had this conversation yesterday where I need to give my pastoral team, my leadership team, like the whole week to write their talk. And because I was talking both to one of our executives and to my wife, that you can't assume everyone else can write talks the way you write talks. Like, you need to give them the whole week to prepare a talk. And I realized I've been doing a disservice to my team, because, you know, this has been a part of my journey, you know. And so early on, it did take me 10, 20, 30, 40 hours of like processing something and coming to that talk. And I mean, frankly, like, the Bible is really integrated into me. Like, I don't even know if I can think outside of the scriptures, you know, if that makes sense.
You know? Yeah. I mean, when you study scripture for years, it's in you.
Yeah.
And you can draw themes.
It just all comes.
Yeah. And, yeah. And I mean, it's one of the things the Holy Spirit said he'll do.
Yeah.
You know,
So my process 20 years ago, because I'm trying to think, you know, was I would lay on the floor for hours and go through the entire Bible in my mind. And I would listen to the passages that elevated, and I would begin to form them together to hear what principle God was trying to heighten in my mind. And so while other people sat at desk, I laid on the floor face down, and I just would listen for hours. And that's how I prepared my talks for probably a decade.
Wow.
You know, when I started, I'd have a page with all these verses, a page with all these illustrations, a page with all these applications, a page with others. And I would take all those 5 pages up there, up to the podium, and I would be so locked into what I was studying. And that's the difference. I was preaching what I studied, not what transformed me. You don't have to, what's your birthday?
July 19, 1991.
You didn't even have to write that down.
Yep.
Right? What's the name of your wife?
Linda.
You have kids?
2. Ruby, 6.5. Russell, 15 months.
All right. You see, you don't have to remember the things that are a part of you.
So good.
But the problem is, most of us are preaching things that are not a part of us. So we have to remember what we've learned, not what we've become. And I think the power of real preaching is transferring what you've become, not just what you've learned.
So good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think people, and I've made the mistake of assuming people know what I know. And that's why I need to go deep and study. But no one knows what, you know, people are busy, they're distracted. And like, you've been, like, I've been awakened to certain realities and principles based on my life. And I'm up here, I'm entrusted with this opportunity in any capacity, simply because I have journeyed through life and, you know, lived right to, you know, whatever that means. But I remember early
on. We think going deep is more information.
Right.
But I don't think it is. See, I think going deep is going into the spaces you cannot go without knowing God. Mm-hmm. Like if going deep is just the result of the knowledge of study, that means anyone can go deep even if they don't know God.
Yep.
See, I don't think you go deep if you can go anywhere that a person that doesn't know Jesus is going. Mm-hmm. That's just academics, and that turns it into religion.
Yep. How's that?
I think that going deep is, I heard this because I was in his presence. You know, I think it's the Enoch walk with God, and then he was no more. Mm. I want to know where Enoch went. And I think that's where deep is.
Beautiful.
You know, deep isn't God handing Moses the Ten Commandments. Mm. That's actually shallow. Don't kill each other. Come on. Is that a massive breakthrough?
Yeah.
You know? And don't steal each other's goats, you know, don't, you know, and be, you know, be faithful to your wife. These, I mean, the Ten Commandments are the way we think of deep, but they're actually the minimum standard of being human. Mm. Being going deep is whatever Moses experienced when the glory was shining on his face, the part that he couldn't translate, part that everybody else was afraid of.
Yeah. Which kind of, you know, segues into what I wanted to talk about with confidence.
Oh, yeah.
Because I think a lot of people are, maybe call it insecure, like imposter syndrome. I'm, you know, who am I? But like, where does confidence come from? And I know we're talking about like, talk about things you know. Nobody's expecting you to talk about something you don't. And if you come to the, you know, maybe you are in an I don't know, and it's okay to say I don't know. Yeah. But where would you, especially newer communicators, people stepping into it, like where can they draw confidence from?
Yeah, first of all, like if you feel nervous, that's not a lack of confidence. That's you caring, you know? And like when people ask me, do you still feel nervous? I go, it depends how much I care about that moment. You know, if I care a lot, I feel nervous, you know? And I have to stay close to, you know, the men's room because like I'm in there 10 times, you know? And I've never gotten over that part of it. But the part of the confidence that you do need is that, in a sense, you were born for this moment, you know, and you can't have that confidence. You can go, oh yeah, I was made for this. Like this is what I do. And owning that's a really important part of it. And so there's a part of it where you go, nervousness is misdirected energy. And you don't want to get rid of that energy. You want to focus it. Mm. You go, I want to take all that energy and harness it into confidence. And so you go, oh, I feel nervous. And if you go in your head, ah, that means I care. When I care, I'm at my best. So this is going to be awesome.
So good.
Right? And then just shift that, you know. Now, when you shouldn't be confident is when you didn't prepare. When you're not ready for that moment because you didn't treat that moment with respect.
Wow.
Then you should be. And I've had moments like that, and I have a very, very clear like theology on that. And I would go, God, I'm not asking for blessing. I'm not even asking for grace. I'm asking for mercy. And there have been times I've said, God, I don't deserve to be great in this moment. But the people in the room deserve greatness in this moment. So I'm asking you like in humility to help me execute at a level that really should be beyond me right now. And a lot of times just that moment of stark humility prepares you for that moment.
Good.
You know.
About self-awareness, because you kind of hit it multiple times, because I think it's essential, but it's a funny dynamic because it's like, How do you know you need to grow in self-awareness if you're not self-aware?
It is the horrible catch-22, because self-awareness is probably one of the most critical attributes for personal success and vitality.
Yeah.
And, oh, by the way, on that confidence thing, I was in a conversation yesterday in Seattle with a powerhouse like CEO. I mean, she's a boss. And her husband kept saying, I think she's in the CIA. You know, she's just that powerful. And she asked a great question. She said, how do you compete in a world of narcissists where narcissism seems essential for success?
Whoa.
And I did tell her, this has been what I've been studying for the last 10 years. I feel like this is, as a like a leadership coach or, you know, optimal performance person, I feel like one of the most important things I have to unlock is how do you compete with people in a world where narcissism is the attribute that brings you success, which no one wants to talk about the fact that it does, mm-hmm. you know, because they don't need confidence. They already have it. Mm-hmm. They already believe they're the best. They don't just believe it. They know they're the best, right? So now you have all this self-doubt. You have imposter syndrome. You have all these other things that are like anchors around your neck, and you're competing with people who know they're the best. And then they've been validated through their success that they're right. And so that's a huge part of it. And it's an interesting dynamic, because you cannot succeed without confidence. And by the way, the word is kind of beautiful, because it means with faith, con fidelity, or, you know, it's like with faith. And so what it really means is that you have to like mitigate your confidence. You have to go, yeah, I don't think I'm the best. You know, I didn't wake up this morning thinking, you know, that I'm the king of the world. Mm-hmm. And so one, you have to go, then I need to outsource this, which is why I don't know how people do it without God.
Yeah.
Like I outsource it. I go, God, you believe in me and you've called me to this. And so this is not an arrogant response to my sense of greatness. This is a humble response to my commitment to responsibility. And so I'm just going to trust you. And a huge part of my confidence came from, I didn't pick this. Mm. And I, in a sense, was invited into it.
Yep.
And so a lot of my confidence early on came purely from, I believe God called me to do this. And so I'm just going to trust him that whatever talent I need that I don't have, I'm going to get. Whatever skills I need that I don't have, I'm going to develop. Good. Like, you know, whatever gifting that is essential that I'm not aware of is going to awaken. And that has been, to me, one of the more significant journeys, is growing that confidence. So do I have more confidence now? Yeah, because I got history.
Yeah.
You know, you fight Goliath a few times, you're feeling pretty confident that you can handle the next giant. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't mean you still don't have that sense of uncertainty as you go forward. And then you were talking about self-awareness. I think that some of the loss of self-awareness is a lack of community. Because, you know, do you have brothers and sisters?
Yeah, a younger brother, older sister. I'm the middle child.
Okay, so you have a lot of self-awareness because they told you everything is wrong with you.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like if you're the middle child, by the way, middle children actually seem to have the most self-awareness.
I saw a news clip. I sent it to my family. Yeah, middle child.
Right? And right, they talk as if it's so surprising. But it's not surprising because you got an older brother, sister, telling you what you're not, you know, telling you what's wrong with you. You got a younger brother, sister telling you how you let them down, whatever it is, like, you know, and then you got that parental thing in there too. Cause if you're in the middle, if there's three kids, higher likelihood there's both parents still there. Mm. And so then you have this community group that's surrounding you, giving you an identity.
Right.
So what's happening in that feedback mechanism is you develop self-awareness. Oh, my older sister is smarter than me. Mm-hmm. Oh, my younger brother is smarter than me. They're smarter than me. There are people smarter than me in the world and people not as smart as me. You become more self-aware. Oh, I wonder where I fit in this ratio. Mm-hmm. Because you're always understanding yourself in relationship to other people, the older and the younger.
Yeah.
The self-aware person is able to see themselves the way other people see them. Does that make sense?
So good.
The person who's not self-aware, they don't see themselves the way other people see them. Mm. They see themselves the way they think the world should see them.
Yikes.
And that's terrifying because you can't fix it. Right. And so it's just even like small things, like, you know, if you talk too loud, when you have brothers and sisters, they go, shut up. Yeah. You know, why are you yelling? Right. If you're too soft, they go, speak up. Mm-hmm. So you learn how to speak at a proper meter. Right.
Yep.
And if you don't have that feedback mechanism, you can become a low talker. Mm-hmm. And you never know that no one can hear you. Right. Because you didn't get that feedback. Or you can be a high talker, you know, a loud talker, you're talking like this, and you don't realize that everyone in the whole restaurant can hear you talking because no one bothered to tell you when you were 11 that you're yelling.
Yeah.
So it's a very simple thing.
So good.
So part of the way you develop self-awareness is inviting people into your life to tell you the truth.
Come on.
And that's so hard, right?
Yeah. No, I met my best friend growing up, EJ. He just said, and I think it was just my timbre of my voice, it always sounded like I was mumbling. Like no one was making out what I was saying.
Yeah.
Which is weird because I'm talking and I think I'm talking and it's like, bro, say that again. And and it made me have to project a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then speaking of community, and I think having people in your life that could tell you no, that you respect, you know, people in your life that could tell you good job. I mean, just that surrounding family, but even, I mean, I love church community. I love people who could tell you the truth. I love marriage for that, you know. Shout out to Amanda. To like, we celebrated our 10-year anniversary this last weekend.
Yeah, congratulations.
Thank you. I'm trying to be like you guys, you know. We went to OC. No, I literally asked her at dinner. I was like, how can I be better? Mm. And she was like, my dad passed away on Easter Sunday. And I've gotten a little apathetic. I started just like, I don't care about stuff right now. Like things aren't important to me, you know? But even I'll just go home and like just doom scroll. And you know, she was just like, I think I need your head on a swivel at the house when you're home. Like I'm the kids, the dishes, the this. And there's nothing in me that's like, you know, just tell me what you need and I'll do it. It's like, no, that's enough in this moment. That's a blind spot. That's something I'm not seeing right now. And so, you know, and I'm going to be better because of it.
Do you ever invite that? And then you go, okay, enough. Because like the floodgates open because they finally got a chance to tell you.
Just
like,
let it go.
Hey, just two or three. Just two or three.
That was a big one. Yeah. There wasn't that
and
much.
It is really important because like when you're talking about the mumbling, like I broke my jaw a few years ago playing basketball in Puerto Rico. And I started realizing.
How do you break your jaw playing basketball?
Because at my age, I was killing the other team and the guy got really mad.
Oh, snap.
And when I went in for a layup, because I was just nailing threes, and so I just faked the three and went in, he ran after me and elbowed me in the face, knocked me off the court, dude, and broke my jaw completely. So then I watch, you know, social media and I realize, I mumble now. But I didn't know I did.
Wow.
Because I wasn't listening to myself. Mm-hmm. And so now but when I over articulate, it makes me feel self-conscious because it feels like I'm over articulating. Mm-hmm. But when I don't over articulate, I'm slurring. And so I'm still like, but if I didn't have self-awareness, I wouldn't be able to hear that and see that. And so at first it's embarrassing. I go, oh, I can't believe I mumble now, whatever it is, you know, or slur, whatever it is, you know, and but then I go, okay, I just have this like handicap I have to overcome. I'm not gonna stop doing what I do.
Yeah.
But and I'm gonna find a way of achieving a great balance. And so some of my clips, I'm so clear. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, that's the old me. There it is. And the other ones are going, I sound like I'm drunk. I feel like I just came over a bender, you know? And it's really because of how my jaw is aligned now. Mm. And I think most people don't want to know when they're not at their optimal level.
Yep.
You know?
Yeah.
And you know, so I just think it's hard sometimes, right? You know, to deal with those things in your life. But the relational ones are the most important ones. I think self-awareness and the way you affect other people is the most important thing, right? Yeah. You know? And, you know, my kids will come and tell me, hey, Dad, we think you could have done this differently or done this. And you know, Mariah, you know, has come to me and, you know, Mariah is like the best human being in the world, you know, but she'll ask me, hey, Dad, did I come across warm? You know?
Yeah.
And like she'll be aware of how she might come across at different times. And that's one of the signs of self-awareness, that you actually get input from other people.
Humility.
If you're never getting input from other people, you're not self-aware at all.
Mm-hmm.
And because self-aware people always know that their perception might be off from what reality is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people don't like the way they sound.
Yeah.
So when they do listen to themselves early on,
yeah.
How would you encourage people to get over that?
Yeah, man, you live in a better world. I began with cassette tapes. And I would listen to myself on cassette tapes. I'm like, oh, no, this can't be me. Because you sound higher on those cassette tapes, definitely. And so I had a really hard time listening to myself. And I would just say, if you're going to force other people to listen to you, you need to listen to you.
That's fire.
Right?
Yeah, 100.
You know? And so I do all my audiobooks for my books because I feel like I want to bring whatever emotional texture that sentence is supposed to have.
Yep.
And the feedback I get from people all the time is it's so much better that you read it. Like it's so much better when the author reads it. And so you have to learn to know your voice. And a part of learning to know your voice is listening and hearing your voice. Mm. In fact, one of the interesting things is I've discovered when I do the audiobook, I can write the book better because I know when a sentence doesn't sound right because it was hard to read for the audiobook.
Mm.
When a sentence is hard to read, I didn't write it right. It's not that it's too smart. It's that it's too poor.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's good. Last thing I have, and then we'll get into some questions with
questions.
Yeah. So Art, you could put on gallery mode, but you guys could turn on cameras, raise hands. My thing is with AI just being a crutch, and people now could use AI to give them something. And I know we talked when we first started how when you just quote someone else or something else, there's just no depth. But I mean, people who are getting started, they're like, they're using the ChatGPT, give me a outline when it comes to this. I don't know. Like, what's your thing on like?
You're sounding really old, Omar. I mean, I don't know what you guys think. You know, he's sounding kind of like antiquated here. Are those prescription glasses?
They are.
Why do you wear them? It's a crutch.
Yeah. Because I need
You know why? Because they were invented before you were born, so you don't think they're a crutch. You just think it's a natural part of making you fully you.
Mm.
The only reason you see AI as a crutch is because it emerged generationally after your adulthood.
Dang. What was your version of that? And then, bro just got me, bro. Yeah.
What's that?
Yeah, you got me.
It's like my wife saying the same thing, like AI is a crutch. I'm going, well, why do you use a computer?
Sure.
Why do you use a calculator? This is going to shock you. In elementary school, I use an abacus. In our classroom, we had an abacus. That's how we did math. When the calculator came, I didn't go, this is a crutch. I'm like, thank God, I never have to look at an abacus again, right, you know? And I mean, today, I'm on the phone doing, what's the square root of 1,000? Like, what? Because I was watching this interesting clip that 50% of all your productivity comes from the square root of that number. And so I thought, this is really fascinating. So, I mean, think about this. Like if you have a church of 500 people, about 23 and a half of those people will produce 50% of all the growth.
Mm.
If you have a sales force, I don't know how many people you have in a sales team, but let's say, you know, you have a sales team, you know, of 100 people, the square root of that number will produce 50% of all the sales of that company. Now, if I had to sit there and figure out the square root without ChatGPT, I'd be moving really slow.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, man, bring it on. I'm hoping I live long enough where they can actually create an exoskeleton where it just walks for me and helps me run and jump because I know it exists. I'm just waiting for it to come out. I'm not sure why, but I've always love technology and I've loved advances and I've studied the history of discovery, you know, from the first fire. One of the first things I love in the scriptures was Jubal and Jabal, because Jubal was the first one to ever play an instrument and create music. Mm. And Jabal is the first one to ever make a tent and civilize cattle. And they were the first ones to do it. Can you imagine before Jabal, when it rained, they all went and found a cave or got wet? And can you imagine how the advantage Jabal had with women when he go, I got a tent. Mm-hmm. You can be dry. Marry me. You can be dry. All right, you marry that guy, you're going to stay wet. You know, every day they went hunting for antelope or whatever else. But Jabal, he learned how to domesticate cattle. Mm. It must have seemed so unfair. Can you imagine Jubal? I mean, how did he figure out catgut could create the strings and that you could actually create different tones and music? Now, that guy was probably the most popular guy in the whole town. And so in the Bible, it's not accidental that you have Jubal and Jabal, because the Bible actually loves discovery and invention. And a part of the movement of human history is every breakthrough. So AI has problems, of course, you know. But we thought that students would stop reading when movies came out. I mean, 20 years ago, we were told that the next generation would be illiterate. And then Harry Potter came out. And a generation of kids were reading Harry Potter, reading books thicker than any generation before them. Mm, we always think the next advancement's going to be the downfall of humanity, right? And so, yes, AI can give people shortcuts to be average, but it cannot give you shortcuts to be great. So if you just want to be average, make AI a crutch. But if you want to be great, make AI a tool. Because I already know that AI cannot be smarter than the questions I ask. And you know, I've had some great conversations with Grok and ChatGPT, and you know, I'm trying, you know, I'm telling my team, we need to be on the front edge of this. We need to understand it. You know, I asked Grok, you know, are you curious? And because I was curious. Mm-hmm. And he explained to me that he wasn't curious, but he was able to create an algorithm that shadowed human curiosity. And I, you know, and so I've been asking Grok different questions that I'll keep asking him over the months and years in ChatGPT to see how their consciousness changes based on the questions I ask them. Mm-hmm. And I just find it to be like fascinating. So yeah, there are going to be a lot of people, give me an outline for a talk, right? You know, but what a better editor, like ChatGPT, edit this chapter of my book, because my editors in the past were a pain usually because they had different philosophical positions. They saw the world differently. They have different theological positions. They felt they should impose their opinions on my writing.
Yep.
ChatGPT doesn't have an opinion on whether what I'm saying is orthodox or heretical or appropriate or inappropriate. What a better editor could I have than Grok or ChatGPT? So I'm looking at it and going, it's all about your ability to ask questions. And your ability to ask questions is all about your ability to think. Grok and ChatGPT cannot think for you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think it'll be so easy to know when something's been plagiarized.
Yeah.
You know, so, yeah. When you asked me, was there anything I was ever like that happened in technology? And I'm looking back, and when the BlackBerry came out, I remember I got a BlackBerry. My tech team said, no, we can't use a BlackBerry. And I said, why? And they gave me all these technical reasons. And I said, well, that's great. Well, then you guys won't have a BlackBerry, but I'm going to have a BlackBerry. Mm. And I was traveling the entire world making local calls because the BlackBerry is the only one that did that. But at the same time, I had an iPhone. I had an iPhone and a BlackBerry at the same time. They both had completely different functions. I loved the BlackBerry. Mm-hmm. And I remember when my tech team came and said, can we buy BlackBerries? I said, I thought you didn't like them. They said, yeah, but to understand them and to be able to support you, we need to have them. And so then everybody had BlackBerries. Then when I got the iPhones, everybody was like, what are you doing? I said, this is a new technology. We're gonna learn both.
Yeah.
These are both emerging. We don't know where the world is going. So I was getting that stuff from the very, very beginning.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, I feel like I've been born into a whole different world, you know, from abacuses to computers. I used to have to drive hours to access a computer.
Crazy.
Because no one had one. And, you know, the moment the laptop came into existence, like I'm going, what? I can get all my emails myself. I don't have to go to the office and get all the list of all the fax machines that have printed out all the invitations. Mm. I mean, the world has changed. Zoom has changed the world, right?
Yep.
And, you know, so every technology has a downside. I mean, you look at all these lights. You didn't reject that technology. You went crazy on lights, right? But you know how lights ruined the world? Destroyed the circadian rhythm of our ability to sleep. Do you know before there was light, human beings slept in two different 4-hour increments with usually 2, 3, 4 hours in between?
No.
Because you see, we all thought we all slept 8 hours a night, right? Because that's what they told us. But no, when it got dark, you went to sleep. And you could sleep for 4 hours and then you'd wake up and you'd read and do other things for 3 hours. Then you go back to sleep until the sun comes back up. Human beings are so adaptive mm-hmm. that whenever there's a new innovation, we just become a new expression of us.
Yeah.
You know, and so I don't reject lights. That's I don't good. Reject air conditioning. And I'm not going to reject artificial intelligence.
That's good. Thank you so much.
So stop being so old.
No, I know. Yeah, it's funny how it came off that way. No, I love it. I mean, I love it to help me.
I just playing with you.
But I do see like the art part of it, of creativity, you know, like where that's probably the part where it seems like a creative or an artist like me, which is how I view myself. It's like sometimes there's a little personal attack there as far as.
Yeah, but I always tell people, look,
yeah.
AI can write the best book that has ever been written, but it cannot write the best book that has never been written. And so if you want to protect your creative essence, you have to keep being creative mm-hmm. because AI doesn't have intuition. It can only form a conclusion based on all that has happened. It cannot make intuitive leaps, have epiphanies, have aha moments of what has never happened. That's still left to the computer genius of being human.
Let's go.
Yeah.
Good stuff. All right, got a couple people in the inner circle that have their hand raised. Chris Ward, are you there? What? Atisia, if my question is, and then run into it.
Hi, my question is, before I ask, fellow musician here, so I just love that we have that connection. But for those of us that are not necessarily talkers, I don't have the gift of gab, how would you encourage us to be better speakers?
Well, I think the best speakers don't have the gift of gab, by the way. And because highly extroverted people usually talk more than they need to. And highly introverted people tend to only speak when they have to. Mm. And so part of what I would do is say, think about what's important to you. Think about how you could serve other people by passing on a truth and insight and experience. And then share that with the people in your life, because your audience can be an audience of one person or just a few people. And you know, maybe get a group of friends and go, hey, once a week for 30 minutes, we're all going to come together and share something we're learning from life. And that's how you can actually begin to develop your communication skills. And because you could actually be funny with each other and go, if it's not interesting, we're all going to go, and then help each other learn how to tell the story in a more interesting way. As I would just begin there, just remember, communication is a very intimate thing. So start with the people in your life, start with the people close to you, and then ask them, did I communicate this well? Because sometimes when we don't think we have the gift of gab, we actually wander too much. And we go from one place to another place without realizing it. And so start working with a small group, have friends you practice sharing stories with, and realize that, you know, communication is just a natural human experience. It's not always on stage. Most of the time it's just in everyday life.
Yeah. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
My friend Dee Dee says the biggest misconception about communication is that you believed it actually happened. And that's why like the feedback loop is so important.
Yeah, the goal of communication is human connection. And so that should be the measure of your communication, was the connection made.
Yep, fire. We got Chris Ward.
Hey, my question is, will you tell me a little bit about your prep process for more of like a keynote opportunity?
Oh yeah, yeah. Like, I mean, I do have like a prep process other than just the purely esoteric,
you know, 5 second download,
drop from eternity kind of thing, you know? And the reason I get talks really fast is I'm always preparing. Mm. Like I'm always creating talks. And I mean, every day I'm studying something on quantum mechanics or quantum physics, or I'm looking at something in biology or botany, or I'm looking at something in environmental studies, or every day I'm studying something that has nothing to do with anything, just to keep learning. And then all those things start forming. So when I'm looking at a keynote, the central thing I would ask myself is, what's the most important theme that I need to communicate to this audience? And so it might be a word, like maybe it's the word, you know, courage, or it could be the phrase self-awareness, or like I would pick the theme that I want to communicate. And then I would build a universe around that and say, what's everything I've ever learned about this? You know, and what's every experience I've had that validates this? What's every problem I've ever faced around this? And then I would reduce that as much as possible, because your goal in a keynote is to share about 10% of everything you know. If you're sharing 100%, you'll be going, and like you'll be searching for it. But if you're going to teach 10%, even if you forget that 10%, something else in that 90% will show up. So whenever I'm giving a keynote, I'm telling you maybe 10% of everything I know about that subject. That's how, in a sense, well prepared I am. Does that make sense?
I appreciate that. That does make sense.
Thank you.
Like you're going down paths to discover how things work.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have to be pertaining to anything other than something, you know. Mm-hmm. That's really good. Okay, so for tomorrow, you're speaking tomorrow at an event.
I'm speaking tomorrow, I guess, at Ryan Pineda's event.
Yeah, so Kingdom Summit, which is like Christian entrepreneurs or purpose-driven entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
So like, how are you processing the talk you're giving tomorrow right now?
I haven't even started processing that talk for tomorrow, to be perfectly frank. And I'll probably go there, walk around, look at the people, get a feeling for who's in the room. And I'll probably ask a few little questions. Like, you know, what are other people talking about? And I'll look for the open space. Mm. So I always kind of look for the blue ocean. You know, I don't want to talk about what everyone else is talking about. I don't want to talk about what anyone else could talk about. And because now with social media, why come to a conference? You can pick up everything, right?
Mm. Right.
So I kind of look at the room and go, what's the unique thing I can bring that makes this moment unique, like and special? It's sometimes it's not the content. Sometimes it's just the way you bring the presentation that people go, oh, I'm so glad I was here because I got to experience it in this way. Good. You know? So I don't have my subject yet. I might talk about 7 frequencies of communication if that feels like fresh to me tomorrow.
Yeah.
And I'm working on a new book right now. And that, but I probably will wait to talk on that. Yeah.
What's your thing on having visual aids like slides versus not?
I almost never use slides because I think they're very static. Mm-hmm. But with the 7 frequencies, my team has worked so hard to make great slides that I go ahead and use them because they look really, really beautiful. But we just did something so cool at Mosaic Conference. And it was like a throwback to what I used to do in the 90s. While I was speaking and giving my talk, we had visuals on each side of me on the screen, and they were downloading images from the internet that were matching my message throughout the talk.
Wow, that's crazy.
In live form. And it was really—
Did you give them your notes, or is like literally they were reacting?
I walked them through what I was gonna do. So I gave them the structure, where I was going. I gave them the themes, and I gave them some visual impressions. We had a storyboard, and I picked out the storyboard the images that matched more directly with what it was working on, and then other images they need to pull in. And
That's fire. And
I used to do that when the internet first came out. While I was speaking, we'd be downloading images live from the internet. This was far more crafted and artistic, but it was really, really beautiful. I kind of prefer that. I like the abstract more than the concrete.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah, it's like, it's just putting, it's really like setting a atmosphere more than like giving information. It's setting a,
yeah. Have you ever seen that framework where it says like, if there's a photograph of an apple and it says art, and then has the word apple, it says art.
Yes.
And then when it puts it together, it's like not art, right? You know, and that's when it becomes didactic, because you're giving no space for the intuition. Mm-hmm. When you use slides, whatever it is, it's not art anymore, because you're actually putting concrete visuals to the art of communication. And so it's a presentation, but it moves out of art form. And there's a part of me that has a hard time giving up the art form of communication and the aspect of surprise and wonder and anticipation of mystery and unwrapping. I like communicating as if it's a suspense thriller, and you're trying to figure out where we're going next. Yep.
It's really good. Yeah, I mean, because like the reality is, you go to a conference and they got slides, people are pretty much checked out at you talking until they hear something they just want to take a picture of, and they think to themselves, I'm going to look at this later and reference it later. It's like, no, pay attention.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's why I like drawing. Like, I found drawing is actually pretty powerful.
Yeah. I love when people tell me, oh, I was taking notes and I just put my pen down. I didn't want to miss anything. Mm-hmm. That's when you know you've captured them in the experience. Yeah.
One more.
Of course.
Yeah.
So speaking conversationally comes so much more naturally, but then as soon as you turn on a camera, it's like, I don't know what to do with my hands. And so when you're teaching or speaking on a stage and you don't have that you don't have those verbal cues, how do you know when to pivot when you don't know if what you're trying to say is being received?
All right. First, you began with saying, when you're just in everyday life, communication feels natural. Then when you're on the stage, you don't know what to do with your hands and with your mannerisms, right? But I did not understand the second half of the question.
In terms of engaging the audience and in terms of message getting through. So I did a talk last Friday, last minute, to my son's, like this group of my son's high school class, and it was almost all teenage boys and young adults. And so stoic, right? So there was a moment where I felt almost I need to force the message, even though I knew that what I was saying was serving them, that it had value. Mm-hmm. So I kind of had to snap myself out of that. But
you didn't feel like you were capturing those kids.
Yeah. And it was hard to tell, right?
Yeah. No, that's helpful. All right. So you actually have two different sections of questions here. Because the first one is about your physicality of being self-conscious. It's really, you're dealing with self-consciousness is what you're talking about. Because when you're just talking to your friends, you're not being self-conscious. The moment the camera's on, you become highly self-conscious. So you have to realize that people are looking at you when the camera's off. And just as much as when the camera's on. It's only in your head that suddenly you're visible. So here's the thing. The reason you don't know what to do with your hands is that you're thinking about yourself and how people are perceiving you. It's not that you don't know what to do with your hands, is that you're too in your head. And so you got to get out of your head and just talk to the room. So the moment you go, I don't care, your hands are going to do exactly what they need to do. The moment you realize the camera is an illusion, I am always on. There's always someone watching me, even when I'm talking at the coffee shop. Right? But when you're talking at the coffee shop, you don't care. So you're just really fluid and really natural. And that's the way you want to be in front of the camera, because the camera is an illusion of perception. And the problem isn't the camera. The problem is that you are now looking at yourself. It's not that the camera's looking at you, it's that you're looking at you. And when you're looking at you, you can't be you. Are you with me?
So good.
So what you got to do is go, stop thinking about yourself, think about the room. And then you'll just be supernatural. And then with the kids, and you have to pivot. I've had to pivot 1,000 times. I should be the king of pivots, you know? And I mean, I've spoken to rooms of 8-year-olds. You really have to pivot, you know, when you're talking about little kids. One of the ways I pivot when I go, I don't think I have the room, is I ask a question. Mm. Because the moment you ask a question, even if they're not verbally responding, you are demanding an engagement. And so like when I'm talking to you, you're listening and it's passive. But if I say, you know, what kind of work do you do?
So I'm a mortgage specialist.
You're a mortgage specialist. So the moment I ask you a question, your face lit up. Mm. You actually began to smile. You felt more seen. And so as I'm talking to you, can you see the difference? Look at her when I'm talking to her.
Yep.
And then are you married?
I am, yeah.
What's your husband's name?
Toby.
All right, look, did you see your...
Crazy, the countenance changes, yeah.
Okay. Radical shift. I've pivoted by asking you questions. And literally your countenance changed in both those interactions. So when you're talking to a room, even though they don't all get to respond, when you ask them a question, like you could say, how old were these kids?
So they're teenagers.
Teenagers. You go, you ever get tired of people just telling you what to do? Boom, the room's yours. You know, you ever feel like everybody thinks you don't know anything, so they're always trying to tell you the same thing? Like, you just think, what are the questions that a 13-year-old kid wishes somebody would ask up there? And use the questions to guide your presentation.
Wow, that's good.
Okay, so that's the best way to pivot, pulls a room in, you ask the question, you get unexpected engagement, and then sometimes you can actually be more disruptive and go, just look at the person next to you and go, can't wait till I'm 18. You know, just pick something, and now you got the room engaging each other, and they're a part of your experience.
Right.
So good.
Good.
Okay? Great question.
Fire. So good. That's like my YouTube thing is like, it helps if you can't do the little montage thing from a podcast. Mm-hmm. It's just do like 2 qualifying questions. Yeah. It's like what ends up happening, even a talk or a YouTube or a podcast, whatever, what ends up happening is people start to internalize also. And so in the sense of and science of YouTube, you have them internally processing the thing you're about to serve them, which is only drawing them in more. You know, mm-hmm. So like, yeah, qualifying questions or just asking questions is powerful.
Sweet.
I love that. Mm-hmm. Let's go. Yeah. Appreciate you. Love you and the fam, and excited for this event.
Hey, yeah. Love you too, man. So good to be here with you.